Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, June 21st, 2008. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. As we've been covering on the LaRouche Show, the breakdown of the global financial system, which was accurately identified by Lyndon LaRouche during his international webcast on July 25th, 2007, has had dramatic effects on every aspect of the economy. Among these are the record numbers of foreclosures, with banks and financial institutions repossessing homes by the thousands every day. There's been a dramatic collapse in the value of the dollar, and now we're seeing a hyperinflationary trajectory, just as LaRouche had warned, which is especially pronounced in the prices of healthcare, fuel, and food. On June 3rd, just a couple weeks ago, leaders of a number of nations gathered at the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization's conference in Rome to address the growing food shortages, which now threaten nearly 2 billion people worldwide. While representatives at this conference rejected the worst option, which was a call for more free trade and more power invested in the World Trade Organization, there was no solution offered. This food crisis is going to become more severe now as a result of the devastating flooding which is occurring along the Mississippi River. In addition to whole towns being submerged underwater, valuable farmland has been flooded and crops and livestock have been destroyed. This did not have to happen. Following the last serious flooding in this area in 1993, Lyndon LaRouche called for a major water infrastructure program in the region, a call which was reinforced every single year before the Congress by representatives of the Army Corps of Engineers. Unfortunately, the Congress did not respond. Again, after the devastation of Hurricane Katrina, LaRouche initiated an urgent call for a national mobilization for reconstruction of the nation's infrastructure. And he said it had to be national, not just specific to New Orleans. Partly in response to LaRouche's initiative, a bill was introduced in 2006 by Representative Lacey Clay of Missouri to fund a kind of civilian conservation corps, which would employ young people in needed infrastructure development, especially in the area of the Mississippi River, which is now being devastated by flooding. But this was also rejected by the Congress. Today on the LaRouche Show, we will discuss what should have been done had LaRouche's warnings been heeded. We'll also discuss the damages that have already been done because these proposals were not implemented, and what urgent measures must be introduced now. First, we're going to hear from an old friend of the program, Bob Baker, who comes from Iowa. Then we'll hear from Marcia Mary Baker, who is, in addition to her services as co-host of the LaRouche Show, she's a leading expert on infrastructure, and you can see her writings on LaRouche Pub and LaRouche Pack regularly. And then Ali Perbatovsky from the LaRouche Youth Movement War Room is also with us today. So let's begin with Bob Baker. Bob, you're very familiar with agriculture in the Midwest, especially Iowa. Why don't you open by just giving us a picture of the damage overall from the ongoing flooding?
Yeah, thanks, Harley. Well, what you have is you got to look at the physical infrastructure and really paint a picture. You have hundreds and hundreds of grain elevators along the Mississippi and farms with grain bins that have 3, 4, maybe 10 foot of soggy, wet grain sitting in the bottom of them. And it's very hard to get that soggy, wet grain out without mixing it with all the good grain. So you got a big problem there. Plus, this stuff starts to mold. You start getting aflatoxin. You start getting all kinds of biological growth going, and in some cases it can actually get get very hot and just destroy the whole bed. You have roads and ditches where the water's flooded over and the currents have just gouged out, like taken all the gravel off the top of the roads or eaten out the sides of the ditches so that they can't be used. you have in the fields, you'll have, especially on the bottom land, you'll have all kinds of silting now, very fine soil that's come in and has been deposited all across the top of the soil. The bottom land, which is the better land, much has been invested in that to get it to that productivity in terms of drainage. But now you'll find silt and sand that would look like snowdrifts across the field in a winter day. And it could be, 3-4 feet deep. It'll take lots of time and lots of effort to remove that and then reincorporate what's left back into the soil over a period of years so that it's productive. You've got hundreds and hundreds of livestock buildings that have been flooded. One of the most stark reports came from Oakville, Iowa, where the county has lots of livestock, hogs in particular. They had 36,000 hogs in the total area, and they tried to remove them, and the water came up so fast that many of the hogs in the confinement buildings, they just had to open the doors and let them out, and they swam and floated many miles. And what happened is a lot of them ended up on these levees with the sandbags, and then they covered the sandbags with plastic so the water doesn't erode them away. And these pigs were crawling up the sandbags and poking holes in the plastic, and so they lined up a whole detachment of police and shot them all. And see, this is an aspect that you don't see coming through the media very, very much. If you go through the sewer systems of the cities and the water systems, you can't imagine the amount of sand and mud that will be deposited in the sewer lines and the water systems that will all have to be scraped out, cleaned, and it may take months and months to get this functioning again. The railroads, whole railroads underwater, whole fleets of semi-trucks floating or the current has lifted them up and piled them in a pile somewhere. Now, that's the physical side, and if you multiply all that time into the psychological impact into the population, which basically are pulling together in the crisis, but when this is all over, it's going to hit people like gangbusters. And you see it in the grocery stores where many people around the bigger cities, because they were flooded, they were all driving out to the small communities, and basically you ended up with a sort of a food shortage on the shelf because the small grocery stores in the outlying cities weren't prepared for that. Plus, they couldn't get restocked because, in one case, Iowa City and Cedar Rapids, two of the heavy hit areas, are 13 miles apart, but you'd have to drive 218 miles to get from one to the other.
Wow. Hey, Bob, let me ask you, in addition to the land that's being hit, there's already crops that have been planted that are moving toward maturity. What happens to these crops when they're submerged for days or weeks?
Well, they're done. I mean, they're covered with mud. Even if the water went on them and receded rapidly, so you could harvest them, they'd be so dirty and dusty it would just be a second-rate feed.
So this will already then have an effect in reducing the harvest for the summer of 2008.
It's going to have a big effect because if the farmers do replant, which means they'll be very late, like corn, in Illinois they figure any time corn is planted after the 15th of May, it loses one bushel per day. And so here we are almost at the end of June, if it dries out enough. But the other aspect is
Bob, let me, just on that, does that mean that, let's say, in a week the water is gone, they start to sift through the damages, it's too late to plant a crop for the summer then?
In many cases, yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
And in cases where you could plant soybeans because you plant those later, you can't because there is so much chemical residue that you would have used for the corn crop that would automatically kill the beans. So you have a compounding situation. Now, you also have some flood health problems that are very concerning because you got a lot of human waste overflows, fertilizer runoff, nitrogen going into the water system.
Does this affect the drinking water then?
It can affect, shallow wells in the Midwest. But then you also have, one veterinarian was reporting that if there's ponded water, flood water on farms where livestock, doesn't have access to it or gets into it, you can have a lot of chemical residue in that water that could kill off the livestock. Hmm. Also, he said not knowing what's in that flood water brings about another concern, something that we haven't had to deal with since the 1950s, and that's anthrax. Hmm. And if they see mortality, the symptoms of that, because anthrax can lay dormant in the soil for decades and even centuries, but this type of catastrophe can activate it.
You're listening to The LaRouche Show. We're discussing the flooding that's hitting the Midwest of the United States, that's moving south along the Mississippi River. And I'd like to bring in Marcia Mary Baker right now. Marcia, this didn't have to happen, did it? I mean, it doesn't seem to me that the rains were so much heavier this year than in the last couple of years. What caused this flooding?
Well, it didn't have to happen because you're talking about this area of drainage called the Upper Mississippi Basin that has not had all that mankind could install in the way of flood control infrastructure built. That's the simple part. To your immediate question about rains, there were some very impressive rains in recent times. Namely, there was a wet spring in much of the runoff area that feeds into the Mississippi main channel. And that's especially in northern Iowa, lower Wisconsin, even up the Ohio, which feeds into the Mississippi in Indiana and also in Illinois. And then after that wet spring, and it was relatively cold, and a lot of farmers put in their crop later than they would like to, so you were already vulnerable, then there were quite a few inches, up to 15 inches, in a very short period of time in early June. So you got a sequence of weather, but this isn't the first time that it's happened in this vast river basin. There was a different sequence in 1993 that led to that epic flood, what they called the Great Flood of 1993, although that was later in the summer. It was July and August. And in past times, in the 1920s and even in the 1800s, on record, you just have a very large area you're talking about. So this would be one of the places on Earth where you would want to focus your technology. And the Army Corps of Engineers calls this the Upper Mississippi Basin. And it just wasn't built up properly.
Well, I assume the Corps has made proposals. You probably heard in the opening I made the report that every single year the Corps is putting forward proposals for the national infrastructure, which are always cut way, way down. But is there a plan for the Upper Mississippi Basin, and what do you know about the funding and the implementation of the plan?
Right. Well, as to the latter question, it's underfunded and not fully implemented at all. To put this in perspective, we are talking about the Upper Mississippi Basin, as I said, and also that's contiguous with the Missouri River System Basin that rises way out in the Rocky Mountains up in Montana. And combined, the full Mississippi, including the lower Mississippi basin, and you know that ends in the Delta area of New Orleans and Louisiana. And so we saw what happened with that when it was hit by the Katrina hurricane in 2005. But what's happened is after some huge floods in 1927, the Army Corps of Engineers, this floods in the lower Mississippi basin. The Army Corps of Engineers came in and said, yes, let's build up flood control systems from top to bottom of this giant system. And they went to work over the Franklin Delano Roosevelt years in the 1930s, and they pretty much built up a great deal of the lower Mississippi basin. You're talking about the states of Arkansas, Tennessee, Louisiana, Mississippi, down to New Orleans. And the problem that hit when in 2005 when Katrina hit is all this wasn't maintained. So the lower Mississippi basin had a lot built. They had diversion channels. They had built-up embankments. They had levees proper. They had flood lakes, you know, that were empty when there was no flood and filled up when there was a flood. So the same kinds of things after the Second World War were on the drawing board to be done in the upper Mississippi, and they were only partially done. I can't say whether you would say there's 30% done, 50% done, but sure enough, it was not at all finished. And so that's the vulnerability, you see. And in 1993, it was estimated that what was in place in the way of levees along the main stem of the Mississippi and then on a lot of the tributaries up there in the north, the Wisconsin, Illinois, and the many Iowa rivers, they reduced the damage in 1993 by 50% by what they had. But hey, they might have reduced it by 80, 90% or more if they had everything. And now, 15 years later, we're getting it all over again.
Well, Marcia, what is the main argument when the Army Corps goes before the Congress and makes a proposal? And I know you've drafted some model legislation also. What's the argument that you get from the Congress when they say, well, we're not going to do it? Is it simply they say we don't have the money, or are there other considerations?
Well, there are several arguments put forward, and then you look behind the curtain and you find a lot of them are from the same source. They have the same mother. One of the arguments, the plain old argument, is we don't have enough money, we can't do it. Well, any society that says, it's like saying, you look at these ruins back in Yemen and Saudi Arabia, where they once had irrigation systems and then gave up bothering, and then the civilization disappeared. So if we don't have resources for protecting ourselves against floods in an area that's known to be a huge runoff area, forget that argument. Secondly, there is a very insidious one that when it's sunny and it's not flooding, and I think you were the origin of this, Harley, picture this development. Some guy rolls into town. He's like the 26 trombone salesman or something. And he's the riverboat gambler that says, hey, don't worry about the future. You have problems now in Iowa. Some of your towns don't have manufacturing. Your farmers aren't getting paid. You can't pay for your schools. Tell Iowa to get money by legalizing casinos. And you have a great amenity here, a tourist amenity called the Mississippi River. So put the casinos on the riverboat. You'll get some money for schools. And don't ruin the view for tourists by building up a great big concrete levee. It's so ugly. Just let people have their little riverside cafes. And that's
I believe we put the headline, "The Devil Comes to Davenport," on that scenario, didn't we?
Yes, we did, and that was September 1993. That's on video. We'll be looking it up, Harley, because we had one of those riverboat casino croupiers come and give a speech about how great it is to not build your levees and keep your view until, of course, it floods and your entire town disappeared. That was Davenport, Iowa. It's still that way.
Yeah.
It's pretty much underwater. So that's the second kind of thing that was a major campaign in all these areas. You look at San Antonio, look at downtown Cleveland, look at Washington, D.C. and the Anacostia River where there's supposed to be a stadium go up. That's, in other words, that's a feature of the last 30 years of the bubble economy.
I wanted to ask about that because you hear some of these arguments coming forward that, well, it's the farmers, they're farming too much. But actually, the one thing that is a problem of development, as I understand it, and I saw an article on this about St. Louis, that as part of the housing bubble, there were housing developments that were built on what used to be floodplains.
I think 30,000 at least, and that's a very big number since 1993. I don't know if that's accurate. The media has it out, and it could be because of just what you're saying. The quick buck bubble for real estate development, either commercial or housing. And that.
Well,
so,
Marcia, I just came up with a solution so that all these foreclosed houses along the Mississippi should float down to New Orleans, and then they can be used to replace the houses that were wiped out by Katrina.
Yeah, they have a lot of pigs resting on the roof right now.
So you can have instant barbecue.
So this is a, just to step away from it, from the broader picture for a second, because I know you prepared some reports, Marcia, for the FAO conference in Rome, and I also want to bring Ali in for a moment, in a moment to talk about this. But in the broader picture of things, this just adds to a catastrophe which is just at its beginning stage in terms of food, but how should the listener think about what's going on there?
Well, this is a hit against one of the most productive areas of the world, the North American Corn Belt, that's going to cost a lot in lost corn, lost soybeans, and also wheat was ready to be harvested in Illinois. Some of that's gone because of the timing of the floods. And some of the farmers and others are trying to guesstimate the volume that's going to be lost. In 1993, you lost several millions of tons of grain. And remember that already some of the grain from Iowa was the world center of corn being used for ethanol. Mm-hmm. So what is 16% of the land, of the farmland area of Iowa, we understand, is definitely affected by the flood to a greater or lesser degree. And remember, the United States itself, everywhere in the country, accounts for close to half of all the world, maybe a third of all the world corn produced, and accounts for over half of all the world corn exported. So if you're reducing this, you're cutting the amount of corn available for Africa, which imports it, and many other parts of the world. So in a week or so, there'll be more reliable measures, but this is a big hit of the total amount of corn, also soybeans, available to the world.
Okay, that's Marcia Mary. You're listening to The LaRouche Show. I'd like now to, well, actually, if there's anyone who has some questions for our panel, you can send them in email at radio@larouchepub.com. That's radio@larouchepub, LaRouchePub.com. Now, Ali, you were telling me yesterday, as part of your investigation of the broader effects on the food crisis, that there's been some motion from governments, including Australia and Canada, to dramatically cut back food production, even though there are these problems with drought in some parts of the country, floods in other parts of the world. What can you tell us on these, what looks like British Commonwealth countries?
Well, one of the biggest developments that just occurred on Thursday, June 19th, in Australia, was you actually had a parliament vote to take down, a single desk vote to take down and basically completely destroy the Australian Wheat Board, which is the one institution that basically installed protectionist measures to keep the wheat farmers from being preyed upon by these grain cartels. And we actually had documentation right there from from some of these farmers. There was a huge farmer rally in Australia, and one of these farmers came up to us before the decision was made and told us that if they dismantled this wheat board, this was the difference between him planting a full crop this year and only half a crop or even no crop. I mean, there's farms being abandoned because of this decision. And this, you can see this in the broader context of a British, empire drive to dismantle these granaries. Because this decision in Australia actually set the precedent for a similar kind of dismantling or attempt to dismantle the wheat board in Canada as well. And this was quoted by one of the members of parliament as saying that this is specifically a precedent to dismantle the Canadian wheat board. So this is big because you have the biggest granaries right now. You have Australia, you have Canada, the United States, all of these areas of the world which can be used to actually quickly and efficiently double food production.
There's also an attack on Argentina, on the government of Argentina, by trying to pit the cartels against the government and shut down production there. It's another important grain center.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the government of Argentina is proposing a protectionist legislation right now for the Argentina grain companies, and there's a huge revolt right now against the government as being, you know, a huge stage revolt against them. So yeah, this is a huge thing that we're fighting internationally.
Well, you also have farmers out on strike, or farmers demonstrating for milk prices in Germany and Belgium. Mm-hmm. The French farmers, who are known to take unorthodox tactics, spraying certain animal fertilizer from what they call honey wagons on city halls to make their intentions known. But Marshall, let me just ask you, because this is where we get to the important issue. If here we have a global food crisis, we have a shattering blow to the center of U.S. food production, and yet for some reason I've heard nothing from either Senator McCain or Senator Obama on this. And in fact, the only discussion you hear is that the two of them seem to be in agreement on the need to have more free trade, more power to the World Trade Organization. What is the issue of protectionism as it's related to the farm sector and food production and national food self-sufficiency?
Right. Well, we're at the end of an era of, 30-some years, especially marked by 1984. Let's start there with the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade Agriculture Round, which they began in Uruguay, where the lie was enforced internationally by these financial interests working through the World Bank and the IMF that said every country's citizens would be better off if they relied on the world markets. The slogan of the GATT that in 1995 became the World Trade Organization was "One World, One Market," and they would put it in 16 different languages. But the market doesn't have anything for you. Even if you have the money, there's nothing on the shelves of the world market for millions of people. And since that's the reality for over a year, and certainly over the last few months, many nations de facto are turning to looking at the fact they should restore their own, work towards food self-sufficiency, or at least not be so dependent on the market that's blown out, both financially and in physical quantities that aren't there anymore of food. One example yesterday, by the way, in the Lent, is that the Security Council of the Nation of Russia met yesterday, and what was on their agenda? Food. Apparently this might have been one of the first times.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the Economic Council of the Commonwealth of Independent States, the former Soviet bloc, met yesterday. What was on their agenda? Food. And a discussion of how these individual nations, not just Russia, but the others of the former Soviet bloc, how they could become more food self-secure. So that old one-world market world, the pretense of that is gone. It was always a lie. It was a way to loot nations. It was a way to have these cartels that Ali mentioned take any of the cartels, the dairy, the frozen food, the grains, take the frozen food cartels, many of them out of London. Green Giant is just one of their brand names. And instead of freezing food in the huge United States that has latitudes to freeze everything from Florida to Maine and Minnesota, they relocated to Mexico, to South America, to Asia, and for all kinds of products. But the end of the line is now at hand, and as Mr. and Mrs. LaRouche, who were in Rome this last week, for many reasons in Italy, but they held one press conference at least that I know of on the food crisis. Food is very personal. It's the upfront issue. We're going to change the world or not, the direction of the world based on this. And so protectionism is now, again, for your farmers, for your agriculture, back on the agenda.
Well, Marshall, let me appropriately play the name for this is the devil's advocate, and it is advocating for the devil, namely Soros and the speculators, but let me give them their due for a moment. They argue that the reason prices are going up is because free trade works because you have supply and demand pressures. Now, many of our listeners who try to organize run into problems of people who are educated or miseducated at American universities who actually believe in these supply and demand curves. What's wrong with the argument that it's a supply and demand question that's causing the prices to go up?
Well, if you have shortages, which we do in different parts of the world, you might have some competing to who's going to get the scarce rice or corn or dairy products by paying a higher price. But hey, that leaves out the fact of these grain speculation exchanges that you might as well call casinos. The famous one called the Chicago Board of Trade in Chicago, obviously. One in Kansas, one in Minneapolis, one in London, one in India, one in South Africa. And these places are going wild. You'll find that prices went way up in recent months as a lot of money flows that the name George Soros is connected to, for certain, didn't have anywhere else to go and speculate in. The casinos for securitized home mortgages blew out in the last year, so you couldn't play that game anymore. So the only game in town, almost, was these still open exchanges, which for what they call agro commodities futures. You know, for you speculate on what the price will be for December delivery of new crop corn that you might harvest next fall, or you speculate on other things, hog's bellies or but rice or something like that, because it's one of the only games in town, and that's been a nominal focus of outrage on Capitol Hill by Congress, who isn't doing anything about it.
Well, these prices started going up before the flooding or before it was even clear there were shortages.
Quite. They went up, yes.
I think, and then the other point is that it's the cartels themselves that are advocating less planting to use the advantage of the commoditization or securitization of crops, so that instead of the idea of planting for a reserve because you need food, they are deliberately creating scarcity. They're shutting down farms in the advanced sector and taking advantage of cheap farms in the developing sector. And Marcia, you and I were in Seattle when there was a rebellion by the farmers from the South saying, we're not getting paid enough.
Right, and that was in 1999, I think. It was called the Battle of Seattle because there was such a because actually there were a lot of British-accented, black-hooded anarchists who who smashed the place down. But the line was put out at that time, especially by London, the British ambassador to the World Trade Organization, who said, we will now that there's a lot of outrage against the World Trade Organization by certain countries and farmers in developing countries, we will befriend the poor nations of the world, we British. His name was Mr. Beyer, I think. And we will fight for ending all barriers to trade and all tariffs by industrialized nations that are preventing the food from Africa and the Caribbean from going to Britain and France and the United States freely. And that's what they've done for the last several years, over 10 years. But it's all blown out now because the sophistry and the cant and the pretense of that is exposed.
Well, you and I personally had several run-ins with Pascal Lamy, who at the time was the head of GATT, who's now the head of the World Trade Organization, who insisted that only free trade will bring the prices that will improve conditions in the Southern Hemisphere, and we're still waiting to see that. And it's never going to happen with free trade because free trade is really just colonial policy. I would encourage our listeners, by the way, who want to know the fraud of this free trade argument, to write in or look on the website. We published a book several years ago called The Civil War in the American System. And the arguments presented in there by Henry Carey and even Abe Lincoln demonstrate that free trade is nothing new. And it was identified by American patriots and producers in the 19th century that free trade was identified as British imperial policy to destroy the productivity of the American farmer. Now, Bob, I wanted to come back to you because you have experience in financing agriculture in the Midwest. You were in Iowa you were from Iowa, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So you have the experience with this. we used to have a sense in the farm sector that it wasn't just about making profits, but it really was about feeding the world.
Yeah, I mean, when the ag crisis hit in the 1980s, the big slogan was, take the culture out of agriculture. And, of course, the culture was to uplift humanity rather than just make money. And what, just to give you an example, there are scenarios now people are calculating that if we continue to use the amount of corn they plan for ethanol, that the United States could be an importer of corn. We could have, in other words, if we don't import corn, we could have negative stocks. And that is just some basic arithmetic based on what the projected yields are, because we've got 20% of the acres are pretty well destroyed, 16 to 20%, but the other 80% or so are not in very good shape either because of massive amounts of rain that's hurt their yield potential.
And Bob, isn't it the case that a lot of farmers from the World War II generation, and even the farmers that were born in the 50s and 60s, many of them have left farming in recent years, and you actually are going to have a shortage of skilled agricultural or family farmers left in the country.
Yeah, there's a article actually in the Wall Street Journal of the son of a neighbor I grew up next to, and he's discussing the fact that it's just like putting gasoline on a fire. He said it makes it even worse what's happening with the flood, but he said he was losing money before that. He's raising livestock, raising pigs, and he said it was costing him $170 to produce a 280-pound pig, and he was getting maybe $145 to $50 for it.
Yeah, Harley, if we could bring that out on your supply and demand question, it's just all how do you answer people?
Yeah.
Bob can say more about this, but one thing, take the world meat supply for country by country and so forth. It's completely insufficient, but what happens is in April in Canada, this is an indicative response by the government, a government in Ottawa. They said, well, the reason that hog farmers are getting less money for their animals, as Bob just said, they're losing $50 or more per animal, is because there's a glut on the market. There's too much meat. So we want to help bring the supply down to the level of demand. There isn't enough demand. So we're going to have a hog kill-off program. And in April, Canada announced this. It solicited a sign-up where if you get rid of your breeding sow, for every one you'll get $225, and you're a farmer in Manitoba or something, you contract to have an empty barn. You raise no more. You don't go back in business for 3 years. Now, this is a lie. That's what the answer is to some ill-informed person who says doesn't supply and demand apply.
Also, I'll jump in because Iowa is the number one hog-producing state and corn-producing state in the nation, maybe the world, and they're now importing baby pigs by the tens of thousands from Canada. This was before the flood, to feed out in the United States because of the drastic shift of currencies, and it's making everything crazy.
And isn't this also with the ethanol running up the price of corn?
Yeah.
That's increasing the cost to pig producers also.
Absolutely. So you have a lot of the extra fertilizer and from the high fuel prices that's now, they put on very expensive fertilizer that's just been washed off the ground, They can't use it on the flooded area, but even on the higher land where they got so much rain, it diluted the fertilizer, especially nitrogen, which translocates in the soil, and it can actually dissipate the percentage that's available. So they expect a much reduced yield from all those types of factors.
Marcia, we have a question from the email from an old friend of yours and mine, Fred Unifeld from, as he writes, Louisiana. And Fred asks, is there anything such that could be called a world market price on any commodities? Under free trade, is there, I guess Fred's asking, whatever happened to parity pricing?
Well, I can say one thing, Bob, and you all can say others. But one thing is, as Mr. LaRouche has been saying about oil pricing, that decades ago there was the idea in practice that you wouldn't have any spot market speculation, this casino stuff that came about in the 1970s, thanks to George Shultz, Henry Kissinger, and the rest. You would have nation-to-nation agreements between oil producer and oil-consuming nations. And similarly with food, you could, it's a situation where internationally, if you want to talk about what should the price be, nations could set it between each other and set a price that would hold up and not be subject to change every few months and every and oftener. So those kinds of things are starting now as the so-called free trade system has blown out. So Vietnam and Philippines just signed a deal this week for rice. India is signing deals with the Persian Gulf nations and so forth for rice. And within the United States and other countries domestically, certainly we need a parity price, that is a price that's on a par with, for a farmer, with his cost of production and with what other productive people are making in the society in which he's living. And that was the 1930s program under Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and Fred Hunefeld and so forth has written about that for Executive Intelligence Review. We have the articles there in 1996.
And that's what he's been fighting for. And I would encourage people, there's an older book that was written by Lyndon LaRouche that has a beautiful discussion of this. It was called The Road to Recovery. You may remember this, Marcia. This was the 1999. It was for the 2000 campaign. And chapter 3 of that book is titled Tariffs and Regulation, the Core Constituencies. And he has a whole section there on the issue of farm parity price and farmers and labor, and also why you have to have a protective tariff. So this is something that people might want to call in the LaRouche pack and get your copy of that. Now, I want to go back to Ali for a moment, because I know that one of the things the War Room is looking at is both with the 1923 DVD, how there was hyperinflation created deliberately by the destruction of Germany at the Versailles Treaty, and then the new DVD that's going to be coming out soon on 1932, the battle between the British Empire and the American system, specifically around the Franklin Roosevelt election. But, Ali, when you look at what you just described with the wheat boards being shut down, the global contraction of food production, the hyperinflation, some people get the idea eventually that this is not all something that's happening by coincidence. And Lyndon LaRouche keeps pointing to the fact that you have a commitment to Malthusian views from the City of London. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I'd say this is the fight right now. It really is. What we're putting out on the 1932, the 1923, literally everything that we are currently fighting for leading into Lyndon LaRouche's webcast is on the issue of the British Empire oligarchical system, which destroys nations. It actually, the fight for food sovereignty is actually a fight for national sovereignty.
Right.
That's what we're really looking at. We're looking at a system which actually enslaves nations. It's a system that is meant to create the genocide of 5 billion people on the planet versus the American system, which is a system of protectionism. Of regulation and of a credit-based system meant to facilitate economic development between nations. And this is specifically what Lyndon LaRouche has been focusing on lately, is the Four Powers Agreement. He's actually writing a paper on this right now to identify the role of the Four Powers in actually starting a new economic system in the world, because our current economic system is completely dead. If you look at it, it's created a huge physical economic breakdown, which expresses itself mostly in the hyperinflationary food crisis. But the real point is it's not necessary. This entire system is absolutely not necessary. And our fight is to make sure we get nations able to produce again, to become, you know, we can get Australia, Canada, the United States to become the granaries of the world. Within a year, we can end starvation and end poverty. You know, we can start rebuilding these great infrastructure projects to improve living standards. And that's the real fight here. This has been the fight for, you know, centuries. Do we actually improve the condition of mankind, or do we, you know, make mankind enslaved and beastly?
Well, Bob, let me just take a look at for a moment, the kind of response you're getting from the Congress. I mean, for example, from Iowa, from what I understand, both Senators Harkin and Grassley are continuing to insist that we have to proceed with taking corn and turning it into ethanol. Is it really just that the farmers in Iowa are so badly beaten down by the last 20 years of free trade economics that they'll give up on this idea of producing food for the world just to make some money?
Well, to the extent there's any leadership to fight it, and that's, of course, where LaRouche's institution as a political leader is so important to set the course. But, I mean, the farm state leaders have, by and large, compromised everything to such a degree that even when they say something good or support something good towards especially food production, it's not enough, not even close.
Well, do you think they're aware, for example, in Iowa, that you have even the French agriculture minister, the German agriculture minister, the president of Egypt, that there are cries, as Marcia pointed out, the Russian National Security Council talking about food, that this four-power potential, that a global rebellion against globalization is possible?
I don't think they have that sense that there's that big of a global battle going on. That's where I think our work's cut out for us to get this across.
Well, you've got a lot of people to call in Iowa then, Bob.
That's right.
I'm sure there are a lot of farmers there who, if they still have phone service, would like to hear about this.
Yeah, but, you know, if they got their snorkel on. But you see, this is the challenge, because I think this is a wake up, this crisis, like this young man who's, you know, losing thousands of dollars on livestock. And getting back to Fred, what Fred brought up about, you know, the discussion on parity, and what Ali said about we need a national sovereignty on a world scale to provide food infrastructure. I mean, the process for decades now has been set up to have cheap grain. It was really cheap, and the cheap grain helped consolidate the livestock industry to the point where now you have 26 livestock producers producing 60% of the hogs.
So you have the cartels, the cartelization of agriculture.
Yeah. They couldn't do it without being hooked into the Cargills and the ConAgras and the big packers and the big grain companies. So they've consolidated the control, and now all of a sudden grain prices go through the roof, and all these guys are going to go broke. There's no way they can't. And so they set it up with a cheap dollar for whole hordes of outside money from Europe or wherever could come in and buy up the food-producing industry for pennies on the dollar.
Hmm. Now, Marcia, with this picture that we've just been discussing, what's the possibility now that we could go back to the Congress with a broader infrastructure plan? I mean, first of all, what would the components of a national infrastructure plan be? And what's the possibility that there's an opportunity now to fight for this and get it implemented?
Well, the kinds of emergency measures that we should have, let me mention some of them, and these are the ones that, as you referred to earlier, are not being raised at all by the Harkin, Grassley, or Obama, McCain, certainly not Bush. You know what I mean? It's an amazing blackout, really, even of what of at least raising what ought to be done.
Oh, I'm just going to interrupt you for a second because there was a truthful statement made by George Bush the other day that I want our listeners to know
okay.
about. When Bush was talking about going over to look at the do an inspection of Iowa, and he was clearly tired from his trip hanging out with the Queen and others. So they asked him, what are you going to do? And he said, well, we got to go and bring help and optimism to the farmers. And, gosh, it just seems like there have been a lot of disasters since I've been president. The president was right. There have been disasters. But it doesn't look like McCain or Obama have anything to offer. So go ahead, Marcia.
Okay. Well, let's think of three areas just to throw it out there. And we'll be doing this, I know, that, you know, this dialogue, these emergency campaigns. Allie has... I mean, there's the LaRouche Youth Movement, LPAC, whole drive on this. But one thing, obviously, on an emergency basis, there should be no grain, no oil seeds like soybeans go to biodiesel, no grain to go to ethanol, and we should make a big issue out of in Canada. No wheat there go to ethanol, which is happening. We should have a floor price, call it that, call it parity, call it whatever you want, for the meat animals, for the grain, for what's out there. So
you need emergency credit for the short term to get these?
Then, absolutely, because yeah. Remember, in 1993, when this hit, the economy of the U.S. was breaking down, but you still had a semblance of rural banks, credit, and something you could access if you were a farmer or a businessman or something in one of these flood-stricken states. Now you don't have that. The banks are shut down. So we need emergency.
So this would be LaRouche's two-tier credit policy, an immediate application of that. Cheap credit for production.
Right, and for processing, and you could put a premium on it so you wouldn't be left with only five processors, Smithfield, ConAgra, you know mm-hmm. what I mean. You can do that. And then on the infrastructure side, which represents a need for jobs, like you mentioned, the Youth Job Corps, which means a tremendous amount of construction work to be done under the leadership of the Army Corps of Engineers, bids to be placed and all. But the concept is this vast Mississippi, Missouri, the upper Mississippi basin, where over 12 million people live, it's not just a channel of rivers that are flooded or certain farms. It's a grid, isn't it, that's fallen apart. You need to restore a true rail grid. You have right now, you're going to have an impact apart from the loss of livestock and grain. You know, the whole barge system of the upper Mississippi is closed. In 1993, it was closed for 36 days. And so this is going to have an effect around the world. Even if the grain was good, it's not going anywhere. And I don't know when it's going to start going anywhere. So you have 200 barges that are just sort of stranded. So how to rebuild? Let me just mention one thing. There were studies done after 1993. There were four studies commissioned of what we ought to do on infrastructure, Harley. And one of them had to do with the enemy, I didn't mention this before, of infrastructure and mankind, the British connected wing of the world that's connected to the World Wildlife Fund. Mm-hmm. It was a group formed in 1973 called American Rivers. It has many well-meaning people who would just like to have clean rivers and no litter. That's okay. But it has some types behind it in the World Wildlife Fund that are completely against any form of flood control. That's been publicized highly in the last week by the Washington Post, others, Fox News, the Wall Street Journal, saying rivers should run freely, you shouldn't constrict them once you have levees that are too high, the streams run fast. Well, that's true, but that's forcing you to be pro or con levees. That's ridiculous. Flood control has many, many elements, and you need them all where the best engineers tell you.
Well, they're basically throwing out 1,000 years of civilization, at least in terms of Western Europe, because the canal system, this is the basis of developing a modern economy.
Right, and let me be specifically on Europe. One of the four studies since the 1993 flood of the Mississippi was done by the Dutch. It's called the Delft study, and it said, go build everything. We did after the 1950s flood, and they said, don't even think of a 500-year flood. That's a kind of engineering term, meaning how what kind of peak are you going to build for? They said, there are parts of the Rhine River that's built for a 1,250-year flood. And so it's a real question of physics and science, which the LaRouche Youth Movement has been putting to people about how to view this planet we call Earth. You can go in and terraform. You can go in and create the landscape. That was what inspired the succession of laws after Abraham Lincoln's period, 1860s, 1890s. You know, it was a succession of laws that allowed the Army Corps of Engineers to get the mission of flood control to begin with. But then they've been demobilized for the last 30 years. So build that infrastructure with this kind of perspective. And the Congress commissioned a report. There's a gentleman named Brigadier General Gerald Galloway. He has a report. We don't even need more reports. We need the engineers to do it up and then have this kind of combined emergency package, which would really be the kind of rebuilding of the nation of the United States occasioned by this big hit on the entire center of the country.
Allie, let me just ask you, as a young person who's just been involved in politics for maybe a year and a half with the LaRouche Youth Movement, when you first came around, I'm sure you weren't attracted necessarily by the idea of infrastructure, but this, what Marcia was just talking about, the potential of man to transform nature. Mm-hmm. How do you communicate to young people, which is what you in the war room ultimately are responsible for, building a growing and expanding LaRouche Youth Movement that's developing its capabilities as a new cadre of leadership for the country? How do you go out and organize youth to support these kinds of ideas of infrastructure, increased agriculture? How do you approach that?
Well, you have to educate people, because the problem in our society is young people especially. I mean, the thing is, they don't really understand what infrastructure actually is. You know, infrastructure is the most amazing thing, because what it does is it grows, your entire civilization grows. What you're doing is you're actually creating a society where more and more people can live, can have, you know, hope and freedom. It's our duty as human beings to go out there and to make the planet livable, to make it better, to green deserts. And the thing is, actually, young people get excited about this. Mm-hmm. When you tell people, when you give them the kind of infrastructure projects that we as the LaRouche Youth, the LaRouche Movement have been proposing for years and years, when you tell them about having, you know, magnetic levitation all over the world, or how you can green deserts so that you have people not starving, you know, you don't have 2 billion people on the verge of starvation. That's exciting. That's actually very exciting, because it's a very human thing. You know, it's a human thing to actually want to improve the quality of life and the condition of life on this planet. And that's how you get young people excited, is you educate them about what our role really needs to be on this world.
And in that sense, Bob, the farmers have always been those people who are out in the front, at least in the United States, in applying science and scientific ideas to improving the potential for all human beings.
Yeah, I think if we can go up and dig a 3-inch trench on Mars, that we could rebuild the Mississippi with all the best flood control you could imagine.
I thought you were going to recommend relocating Iowa farmers to Mars. Not a bad idea. We have about a minute and a half left. Marcia, as the resident infrastructure expert, you're convinced this could be done if we had a national commitment to it.
Oh, yes, and this is going to be the only debate. People who want to eat, that's most everyone you can imagine, is going to be able to take sides. That's what, as Allie said, that's what the LaRouche Political Action Committee is doing. Look, you mentioned space. If you go out into space, if you're if you've seen these satellite photos and you take them of North America, you do see a great big diversion channel, a big feature of the surface up around the Winnipeg, and that's because the Red River, which rises in Minnesota and the Dakotas, that flows north, once in a while it floods. And decades ago, a mayor named Duff, a nice Scots Canadian, said, we're going to build a ditch, and it'll be sitting there, ugly, but whenever it floods, Winnipeg won't get flooded. And you can see it from space. It's so big. It's called Duff's Ditch. And we can do that. That's how we can deal with the planet. And that's what
we can build a trench through the Rocky Mountains to bring water in from Alaska. And we can build irrigation to green the Sonora Desert in Mexico.
And what Ali said, it's true for a person of any age, young or old. There is a deep human interest in the truth, and this is true. It's not true. Rivers can't be tamed.
Well, Marcia, Bob, and Ali, thank you very much for joining us today, and I hope we've given some real hope as opposed to what we hear from one of the presidential candidates. This has been the LaRouche Show. We're live every Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. See you next week.